moment, it is worth pointing out that at Alexandria, we basically see science. Philosophy actually remains very much in Athens. What we are beginning to see is this division between what we would think of as the sciences and what we would think of as the arts. Now, the ideal, for example, in the Academy and in the Lyceum, Plato's school and Aristotle's school, had been to unify, to integrate these bodies of knowledge. Think of Aristotle, to go no further, and his interest in the world of natural science going back to Thales, and his ability to develop a whole philosophical approach to things based on his understanding of the natural world. Slowly but surely, however, that begins to change. That begins, these two trends, these two traditions, these two possibilities of knowing begin to divorce one from the other. And I think there has been some considerable tension throughout the history of Western civilization since Hellenistic times addressed to the problem. Are they separate and distinct, or can they again be brought together? I think we've probably made a concerted effort to bring them together, but we have not succeeded very well. You stop and think, for example, of the distribution requirements or the general education requirements, however you want to describe them, in most colleges and universities. You take some English, you take some language, you take some history, you take some math, you take some science. There's still this idea that to be liberally educated, you have to know this range of things. And then there's also the idea that if I'm interested in this, I don't want to do that. You see? So this break that comes in the Hellenistic period has been a durable one. Now, the Hellenistic period was indeed important for a number of scientific breakthroughs. If I'm going to say that Alexandria was a place where science was important, let's have a few examples of this kind of thing. Euclid, for example, around about 300, formulated the rules of geometry, the rules of Pleiadian geometry. The essential rules, the essential formulae, the essential theorems for explaining sort of plane surfaces. Archimedes, another of the important Hellenistic era scientists, 287 to about 212 BC. Now, Archimedes was sort of a Mr. Fix-It. He's famous for making all kinds of gadgets. But actually, there's something else rather interesting about Archimedes. This is the emergence of experimental science. This is the first time we really begin concretely to see something like experimental science. The attempt by experimentation to arrive at a point and then to be able to confirm a point, a theory, an argument, an idea, a mechanical contraption, whatever it might be, to be able to confirm it by repeated demonstration, by repeated testing. Before this time, now, Aristotle, of course, and the traditions behind him, it said, you must observe closely. But there had not really been the experimental dimension. This is added in the Hellenistic period. Aristarchus, around 275 BC, articulated for the first time the heliocentric theory. Center's no problem. Helios is Greek for sun. He put the sun at the center of the universe. Now, that's a rather interesting thing for an earthly person to do, I suppose. We now know, of course, that the sun isn't actually the center of the universe. But we do think of the sun as the center of our solar system, which is merely one part of a large galaxy, which is merely one part of a much larger universe. Now, that astronomical lore was not yet available in Hellenistic times. And as we'll have occasion to see, very near the end of our course of lectures, as late as the 17th century, fellows like Galileo could get themselves in trouble over this heliocentric theory. It had not, in fact, triumphed. It was not regnant. A man by the name of Eratosthenes, 225 BC, by process of quite simple intuition, calculated the circumference of the earth and managed to do it to a remarkably accurate degree. Ptolemy, the Ptolemies, of course, were the rulers of Egypt, but there were members of the family, of course, who never got to be the ruler, so they sort of went off and pursued other interests. One of these, Ptolemy, who lived from 127 to 48 BC, really began to systematize astronomical information. He began to collect enormous amounts of material that had been observed of the heavens above us, and he began for the first time to try to create a theory that would explain planetary motion. I mean, this quite simply is that if you collect, this problem is occasioned by the fact, if you collect a lot of information about the way the world works out there and the way the planets are going around out there, you notice that there's something slightly odd. They're not all moving at exactly the same speed, at exactly the same order, in exactly the same place. They seem to kind of move around. How can this be? Well, one of the things Ptolemy recognized was that we were going to need more sophisticated mathematical models to explain what was going on. And he, for the first time, sort of introduces mathematics into astronomy. Now, there were some very elementary errors or misunderstandings in Ptolemy's time. He thought orbits were circular. It was a very long time later they realized that orbits were elliptical. So it's early in the 17th century, again, that Johannes Kepler can do the mathematics of astronomy as we know it now, you see. Ptolemy made some pretty remarkable steps for his time. So that's the kind of thing that we see as characteristic, perhaps, of the culture of the museum. Now, elsewhere in the Hellenistic world, we also see the emergence of some new literary forms. Some of the older Greek forms persisted. History continued to be written, poetry continued to be written, and so on. But we find something new, for instance, in the Argonautica, The Journey of Argo, a story written perhaps 295 BC or thereabouts by Apollonius of Rhodes. Now this